The Divine Souls. The last couple of days I've been explaining to you about the path of Gyan, the path of knowledge. Although there are three paths to God, karma, Gyan, and bhakti, but we have to remember that karma on its own is incomplete without devotion to God, and so is Gyan. The Gyani has to become a Gyan yogi by surrendering himself to God through bhakti. Now, Gyan is also necessary on the path of bhakti. One shouldn't think that just because there's one Gyan marg and there's one bhakti marg, that on the path of bhakti we don't need knowledge. No, we do need knowledge. We have to have correct understanding so that we know how to follow the path and why we should follow the path. Otherwise, we'll have no stability on our path of devotion. However, bhakti is not dependent to gyan. Eventually, on the path of devotion, you leave behind the need for knowledge, and you ever remain drowned in the love of Sri Krishna. But on the path of gyan, you never transcend the need for bhakti. In fact, at the highest stage of gyan, called Atma Gyan, the gyani has to do bhakti. And not just bhakti to formless God like he has been doing. The gyan yogi surrenders to God, but surrenders to God as formless God. Well, in the end, he has to surrender to the personal form of God, because impersonal God or formless God is akarta, which means he doesn't even grace. So, nirakar brahm cannot even grace the gyani to get liberation, even if the gyani wants to surrender to him. So, the gyani has to surrender to Sri Krishna himself in his personal form, because Sri Krishna grants liberation, not nirakar brahm. Nirakar brahm, purusham brahma yonim, Ved says. Nirakar brahm comes from the personal form of God. Brahmano hi pratishthaham, Gita. Formless God is established in the personal form of God. So although a jnani can worship Shri Krishna's formless aspect, yet that formless aspect cannot grace the jnani to get liberated. He actually has to surrender to Shri Krishna himself in his personal form. Then he can get liberation. So when he surrenders to Shri Krishna, he receives Brahma Gyan, and through that Brahma Gyan he gets moksha or liberation. I explained to you that this path of Gyan is very difficult. It has a very high qualification to even get to hear the philosophy related to meditating on formless God, because an ordinary person is not even qualified to meditate on formless God, which is the main practice of the path of Gyan. The Gyan yogi is joining his mind with God by thinking of formless God, who's everywhere, and he's one with formless God. But I told you that to think of formless God is impossible for an ordinary person, because it's totally abstract. It's like if I tell you, think of a formless tree. What will you think of, right? Thinking of formless God. The second I say God, you want a form. If I say think of something, meditate on something, you need a form to focus your mind on. So, meditate on a formless tree. You'll think, what is this person? Has he lost his mind? Why is he telling me to meditate on a formless tree? It's impossible. Well, for an ordinary person, meditating on formless God is just as impossible. That's why you have to be very highly qualified to even attempt this meditation on the path of Gyan. The qualification is you have to be totally renounced from the world. no desires, no attachments in this world, and control over your mind. So, if I gave you a challenge to go out into this world, and not counting God-realized saints, because that would be cheating. If you can bring me one person who's not God-realized, who has their mind under control, and who has no worldly desires or attachments, I would be very impressed. I would think in this day and age it would be impossible. There is no such person. Only a God-realized soul would have that qualification. So who is qualified to follow this path of gyan? In Kaliyug, nobody. Kaliyuga yoga na yagya na gyana. Ramayana says in Kaliyug, you can't do yagya, you can't follow the path of karma properly for this reason, and no one can follow the path of gyan either, because no one's even qualified to start. You have to be totally renounced to even listen to the philosophy. And then when you listen to the philosophy, it's extremely difficult to understand. Then you have to do manan of that and meditate on it. And eventually you enter into samadhi. You have to practice this samadhi for many, many lifetimes. Only then the heart becomes fully purified. I explained to you that the path of gyan goes against the natural flow of the mind. The natural flow of the mind is to think things and desire things. Really, the two are one and the same. Why do we think? Because we have desires. What do we think about? The things that we desire. And that's the natural, continuous flow of the mind. Nahi kaschit charnamapi jatu tishthatya karma krit. Gita. This mind never remains still for even a fraction of a second. Why is that? It's forever being propelled by desires. Of course, the original desire is the desire for God, which is experienced in the mind as a desire for happiness. And since that desire can never be taken away, because it's our nature, so the mind is always forming fulfilling desires. Fulfilling desires meaning desires that the mind actually creates, thinking that if I get this object of my desire, that will fulfill my original desire to be happy. So the desire for money is not an original desire, it's a fulfilling desire. We created a desire in our mind to get money because we believe that getting money will make us happy. So happiness is the real thing we want. We create a desire in our mind that this person should love me. Why? Not just for the sake of love, no. Because we believe in our mind that if that person loves me, I will be happy. So the desire for happiness is our only original desire, and it's the nature of every soul to desire happiness. And until we find divine happiness, our mind can never rest. And once we find it, then it becomes satisfied. Then it rests. But until then, we're ever busy, and this mind goes on. I used to think meditating meant having no thoughts. It's very frustrating. If any of you sitting here have ever tried to think nothing, it's like a paradox. How can the mind, which is 24 hours a day looking for happiness, just stop and think nothing? It's against the nature of the mind. But on the path of gyan, this is what you have to try to do. You have to eliminate the desires of the mind. Now you do it with logic. You get the knowledge that all this world is temporary. Nothing here is yours. Everything is going to be lost or destroyed one day. Then why think of it as your own? And why look for happiness from that? So don't desire anything from this world. Don't be attached to anyone in this world. So you remove all the desires in that way. In other words, you stop the flow of the mind in its quest for happiness. This is unnatural. That's why it's so difficult to do. If you can do that, then you can hear, okay, this is the philosophy of formless God. Then a true guru, a true saint of that class who's attained formless God, can instruct you, okay, this is what formless God is like, here's how you meditate. Then you start meditating and you go for your whole life and many, many lifetimes practicing this meditation so that you can enter into samadhi, which is actually that thoughtless state. But you can't stay in samadhi for long in the beginning because you have all these sanskars that arise and enter your conscious mind and revoke that samadhi. So then you have to again try to meditate and go into samadhi. The more your heart purifies, the longer and longer you stay in samadhi, and the deeper and deeper you go in that samadhi. While the jnani is in that samadhi, it's like he gets a break from maya. He's not free from maya, but he gets a break. Like if some bees are chasing you, and you're running for your life, there's a whole nest of bees chasing you, a whole hive. You see a lake and you just dive in and you stay underwater. As long as you're underwater, the bees are circling above, but they can't sting you. As soon as you come up for air, all of those bees start attacking. That's like the jnani going into samadhi. The true jnani following Gyan Marg, when he's in samadhi, he has no thoughts, no desires. In other words, he's free from all, everything for that time. But again, his mind comes to the surface, and what's waiting for him there as soon as he surfaces? Worldly desires, attachments, everything. So then he has to try to go back into samadhi. This is the path of jnana. It's very difficult, very long, very dry. Dry meaning, like I said yesterday, I gave you the analogy of someone who hadn't eaten in 10 days, and he's got his hands on a stale piece of bread, dry bread. And you tell him that bread is worthless. Who would eat such a thing? Get rid of it. Why would he get rid of it? He has nothing better. But this is, in effect, what you're telling your mind on Gyan Marg. You're saying, this world is useless, it has no happiness, just let go of it, forget it, let's get liberation. Why would that person want to let go of the bread? Give him something better. On the path of bhakti, we give something better. I explained this yesterday as well, that bhakti goes with the flow of the mind. It's the nature of the mind to desire happiness, and it forms five types of fulfilling desires in order to find that happiness. The desire to see something that will make us happy, hear something that will make us happy, taste something that will make us happy, smell something that will make us happy, and feel something that will make us happy. Five kinds of desires we have. And on the path of jnana, you have to renounce all five types of desires. Whenever your mind desires the world, starts thinking about enjoying something, no. No enjoyment for you. No worldly enjoyment. Eyes, get back here. No seeking beauty in this world. There's no happiness in worldly beauty. Ears, get back here. There's no happiness in any kind of worldly sound. Forget about that. We're going back into samadhi. On the path of bhakti, it's different. We accept the desires and we keep them. In fact, we want to strengthen them. However, we want to divert them towards Sri Krishna. You use a similar logic, and I explained to you in depth about the nature of worldly pleasure, how it's not true happiness, and it's not ever going to satisfy your soul. You can try for uncountable lifetimes more, because we've already been trying for uncountable lifetimes to satisfy our soul with material pleasure. Keep trying for another uncountable lifetimes, it won't work. However, instead of just saying, thus my mind, forget about desiring the world, we say, no, your desire is correct. Your search for happiness is correct. It's just directed in the wrong field. You are looking for happiness in this world? Well, I can give you a better object of enjoyment, a better object of happiness. You want to see beauty? Do you know what saints and scriptures have said about Sri Krishna's beauty? His beauty is such that you can look and keep looking and never get bored. And every moment you feel like the beauty is new. Like you're thinking, but I was just looking at his face and it was beautiful a minute ago, but now it's more beautiful. No, wait, now it's even more beautiful. Oh no, now it's more, and it keeps going on like that. Pratikchana vardhamanam. And then if you stop looking at his face and you look at his hands, you think, oh no, his face was beautiful, but his hands are more beautiful. Then you look at his charan, his lotus feet. Well, I thought his hands were beautiful, but his feet are even more beautiful. Then you look back to his face. Oh no, I was wrong. His face is the most beautiful. You keep going like that forever and never get bored. In other words, instead of snatching that stale bread out of that beggar's hands, you're putting a 5-course, home-cooked, nice, hot meal in front of him. You're saying, why eat the bread when you can have this? He says, oh, okay, that looks great. He'll apne aap bhul jayega. He'll forget about that dry piece of bread on his own. So Sri Krishna can be experienced with all 5 of our senses. And the path of bhakti teaches to keep your desires, but divert them towards Sri Krishna. All 5 desires of the senses can be diverted towards Sri Krishna. So meditation on the path of bhakti is very similar to how we dwell on, or you could even say meditate upon, the objects of desire of the world. It's very similar. When we deeply desire something or someone in this world, they're in our mind, and we're constantly thinking about the qualities of that person, the way they look, or anything. We keep thinking about it. How is it going to make me happy? You do the same thing with Sri Krishna. You think of his form, think of his good qualities. Think of seeing his divine beauty, thinking of smelling his divine fragrance, hearing his voice, his flute, the jingle of his anklets. Use all 5 of your senses, and it becomes a form of meditation. Just like you can imagine meeting a loved one, you think about it in your mind. Oh, when I meet them next, it will be like this. You think of meeting Sri Krishna. So the way of thinking is already natural for us. We already know how to do this. We just divert it towards Sri Krishna. So it's for this reason that the path of bhakti is so easy. Because you're not going against the flow of the mind. You're going with the flow of the mind. You're not telling the mind to stop desiring. You're saying, desire this. This is better. There's real happiness in Krishna. There's only illusory happiness in the world. even if someone succeeds in qualifying for the path of Gyan, they still have a very long and arduous journey ahead of them, because it just doesn't get any easier. You still have a material mind. Deep in your mind, you're still desiring sensual enjoyments. And the Gyani has to keep control over that desire. Thus, it's very easy for him to fall. If he can fall from that topmost state of Atma-Gyan, if he fails to surrender to God, then he can also fall at any step along the way. And he does. Again and again, the Gyani can fall from his path. However, Tathānate madhavatāvaha vachit. Tathānate madhavatāvakvachit brashyanti margātvai baddhasau hridā. Tvayābhigupta. Vicharanti nirbhaya bhagavatam. O Madhav, O Shri Krishna, you never let your devotee fall from the path of bhakti. Tvayabhi gupta, you're hiding out in his heart, keeping care of him. So he's fearless from this world. He's fearless from falling from this path. In the whole Gita, Shri Krishna makes this promise in one place. Ananyaschintayanto mam ye jana paryupasate te sham nityabhiyuktanam yogakshemam vahamyaham. I take the full responsibility of my surrendered devotee. I protect what he has gained and I ensure his further progress. He doesn't make that promise for the Gyani. For the Bhakt, he says, Samoham sarvabhuteshu name bhakta pranashyati. Samoham sarvabhuteshu name dveshyosti napriya ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya maite teshu chapyaham. He says at another place in the Gita, I treat everyone the same. In other words, I give life to them and then I keep track of their karma and I give them the results. However, the one who worships me through bhakti, my bhakt, I live in him and he lives in me. He doesn't say that for the Gyani. Chipram bhavati dharmatma shashvat chantim nigachati kaunteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashyati. He makes a promise in the Gita. My bhakt can never fall. Why? Because he's protecting. It's like a contract. You're following the path of bhakti. You're surrendered to me. I have taken your full responsibility. So what does that practically mean? Practically, it means that just as the Gyani struggles to keep his mind under control, so does the Bhakt. However, because the Gyani is meditating on formless God, he doesn't have the advantage of receiving and experiencing God's grace as a part of his path. At the very end, he surrenders to Shri Krishna, receives Shri Krishna's grace, and becomes liberated. But up until then, he did the whole thing through his own willpower. Can you imagine? But the Bhakt is surrendering to Shri Krishna in his personal form right from the beginning. So Shri Krishna is gracing him. To the extent of his surrender, he's receiving Shri Krishna's grace already. 10% surrender, 10% grace. 50% surrender, 50% grace. And that grace is experienced in the heart as a feeling of closeness of Shri Krishna, feeling of pleasure, like a pleasurable experience in your heart, feeling of love, feeling of security, feeling of joy. That's all Shri Krishna's grace. So he's drawing the mind more and more towards him, and the mind is feeling, oh yes, what the scriptures have said is right. I'm feeling this happiness, even if it's just a small reflection of the real divine thing. Yet, I'm experiencing it. It's real. So the mind, just like you gave that hungry person a little taste. He says, oh, that was really good. Can I have some more? So the mind starts to want more of Shri Krishna's happiness and gradually releases its worldly attachments. This all happens through Shri Krishna's grace. But the jnani is not receiving that grace because he's meditating on formless God, and formless God does nothing. So formless God does not grace. Nirakar Brahm does not grace his devotee. So the jnani has that dry experience, first of all, of having to totally renounce the world and renounce the quest for any kind of pleasure, and isn't receiving any kind of joyous devotional experience, just has to keep his mind on target. We want liberation, so we have to keep our mind out of the world. And in addition to this, Shri Krishna also protects us when we're having a bad sanskar. Let's say the jnani gets a bad sanskar. It's up to his own willpower to keep himself from totally falling back into desiring this world. But the bhakt has Shri Krishna's help, like a security blanket. When worldly sanskars come and the pull is strong on the mind to enjoy worldly things and forget about God, yet as long as this devotee has not decided, I'm done with this, I don't want to find Krishna, I don't want to follow this path of bhakti, as long as he's not at that point, he's just having worldly thoughts. He's more drawn towards the world than towards Krishna because of some worldly sanskars. Krishna protects that devotee. He doesn't say, oh, you're going back to the world, okay, forget about you. He just has a bad few days or few weeks or few months or however long this bad sanskar lasts for. But the whole time, Krishna's holding on to him. He doesn't allow that devotee to lose what he gained. The jnani, if he starts slipping, is like you're climbing a slope and you start slipping. You come all. When do you stop? When you reach the bottom, right? Like falling down the stairs. You slipped on one stair, right? But then you just tumbled. And you didn't stop until you hit bottom. That's how the jnani falls. But the bhakt doesn't fall like that. He slips, Krishna's got him. You're not going anywhere. He's waiting for ki hum hosh mein fir se aa jaye. When the bad sanskar goes again, we come to our senses. Oh, what was I doing? What's so attractive about this world anyway? I could have been spending my time in devotion. We eventually will come to our senses, and at that time, Krishna makes sure we still have everything we had gained before. We didn't slide all the way down the slope like the jnani does. And then he boosts us farther up when we keep practicing devotion, so we keep rising higher. That's what he means by yoga kshem vahan. I protect what you've gained and I ensure your further progress. What a huge advantage on this path of bhakti. The Vedas say it's like the difference between a bandar ka bachcha and billi ka bachcha. the baby of a monkey is he's self-responsible for holding on to his mother, right? You would have seen some movie footage, or maybe you would have seen in real life, that a baby holds on to his own mother, a baby monkey. And then the mother goes and jumps from branch to branch and tree to tree. And if that baby lets go, that's it. He falls to the ground and gets hurt or even killed. The mother's not holding on to him. It's up to him to hold on. That's the path of gyan. Bhagwan's not holding on to the gyani. It's up to the gyani to hold on and stay on his path. But the bhakt is like a billi ka bachcha, the kitten who's held in the mouth of the mother cat. That kitten is nishchint, right? The cat can go anywhere. The kitten's not worried. He's just along for the ride. So Krishna has a hold of his devotees and will never let them go. So you see, the path of gyan is difficult to qualify for. It's difficult to follow. And you're going to fall from the path again and again. Whereas on the path of bhakti, anyone can qualify. All you have to have is a desire for God, no other qualification. Following the path is very natural because it's simply a matter of lovingly remembering Shri Krishna and increasing our desire for Him the same way that we normally think of the world. Instead of thinking of the world, we think of Him. And in addition to that, we have Shri Krishna's protection on this path, whereas the jnani has no such protection. And in the end, after doing all of this, the jnani still has to surrender to Shri Krishna in his personal form. So what was the use of him doing all of that effort on his own when he could have just surrendered to Shri Krishna in the beginning? It's like you see a beautiful palace across the river, but it's a wide river. You don't think you can swim across it. There's a boat and someone waiting to take you across. He says, just get in, I'll take you straight across to the palace. That's the path of bhakti. The path of jnana is when you say, no, I'll find my own way across. I'll walk along the bank, through the jungle, find some place to ford the river, find my way back down the other bank. Who knows how long the path may be through the jungle? What dangers may be awaiting you? Will you get lost? Will you find your way? Will you be able to cross the river? Will you be able to find your way back down? So it's much longer, much more dangerous. This is the path of jnana. So you would think, right? Like Shri Krishna says, Te prapnuvanti mameva. The jnani who succeeds in doing all of that and in the end surrenders to Shri Krishna, he also comes to Shri Krishna, just like the bhakt. So you would think now, at that point, the jnani has become a jnana yogi. He surrendered to Shri Krishna, got his grace and got liberation. And the bhakt has surrendered to Shri Krishna wholeheartedly. He purified his heart by following the path of devotion. He also received Shri Krishna's ultimate grace and became God realized. So now you would think, in all fairness, they should both have an equal experience, right? Even though the jnani followed a much more difficult path, you would think now that he's finally reached Shri Krishna, his experience should be at least equal to the experience of a bhakt. However, saints have explained that there's some difference. This is also a big confusion in the world. People tend to think that if you attain God, you attain God. End of story. Nothing more to discuss. No, there's a lot more to discuss. Because attaining God can happen in many different ways. We'll just look at it from two perspectives for the time being. Either you attain God in his personal form, or you attain God as formless. Simple. The jnani was worshipping formless God, and the bhakt was worshipping a personal form of God. Shri Krishna has many personal forms. So the bhakt attains God in his personal form, and the jnani attains God in his formless aspect. So it sounds different, doesn't it? It is different. Saints have given an analogy. They've said, think of a woman who's become pregnant. She wanted to have a child, and she finally became pregnant. Now she's happily thinking, oh, what will my son look like, or my daughter look like? His nose will be like this, his eyes will be like this. Oh, when he looks at me, he'll smile like this. He'll have little hands like this and little feet like that. She's imagining all of that. But she still can't see him and touch him. She's just thinking about it. It's like an abstract thing. Then her son is born, and she gets to actually hold him and hug him and kiss him and see what facial expressions he makes, and he's learning to talk and learning to walk. Now, if you ask that mother at that stage, who's now enjoying the Bal Leelas of her little child, watching all these cute behaviors of small children, ask her at that point, do you prefer the pleasure you're getting now, when you actually get to see and touch your child? Or do you prefer that when he was nirakar? When he was just an idea in your mind? She'd say, obviously every mother is going to say, I prefer this. I want to be able to touch and see my child. So it's a similar or something like this is the difference between the experience that the bhakt gets after God realization, to be able to see and touch and hear and experience the personal form of God with all five of their senses, compared to the jnani who has no such experience. How can you experience something which has no form, no characteristics of any kind? Then what does the jnani get after he surrenders to God and becomes liberated? It's called Brahmanand. Brahmanand means the bliss of formless God. So he does become blissful. The jnani becomes blissful. And that bliss is unlimited. And the bhakt also becomes blissful. He's attained God. He's become also blissful, and that bliss is unlimited. But there's a difference. Just like the mother was happy thinking about her child before he was born, but that happiness is completely different than the happiness she gets when she can actually see and touch him. It's the same thing. The bhakt can see God, touch God, talk to God, hug God. Compare that to just a formless conception of God's omnipresence and your oneness with him. One is concrete, one is totally abstract. So the jnani doesn't experience God through his five senses. He conceives the blissfulness in his mind. That's it. But the bhakt experiences that divine bliss with every pore of his body and all five of his senses. Another analogy that saints have given is like you have sugar cane. From the sugar cane, you can get gura, like unrefined sugar they call jaggery in English, gura. You can further refine that and get chini, sugar. You can further refine that and get mishri, the most refined form of sugar. The gur is more sweet than the ganna. Although it's all the same, right? And the chini is more sweet than the gur, although it's the same thing. Basically the same thing. And the mishri is even sweeter than the chini. So if someone argues that, but it's the same thing, who cares? Okay, then, the next time that person comes to your house, put a stick of sugar cane in his chai instead of mixing in some chini. Kya baat hai, bhai? Ek hi baat hai. He'll be insulted, right? Even if you give him gura, he'll be insulted. He won't say anything at the time, but after he leaves, he'll say to his wife, "Did you taste that? Did they put gura in the chai? What, they don't have any sugar in the house? What, it's the same thing. What does it matter?" No, yes, it's substantially the same thing, but the experience of that thing is very different, isn't it? In practical, real experience, it's very different. Very different. It's like if you say, a rose flower and a rose leaf are the same. Yes, genetically they're the same. If you analyze the DNA, no difference. If you take a flower and a leaf from the same plant, the DNA will be identical. But if you give someone a rose leaf on their birthday, or you give someone a rose flower, the reaction is going to be very different. So something like this, the experience of the personal form of God, Sakar Brahm, it's more elevated, it's more enriching than attaining formless God. And there's another analogy that Jagadguru Sri Kripaluji Maharaj uses. He says, a sandalwood tree, just the bark from that, or the wood itself, is so fragrant. Imagine if that tree had a flower, which it doesn't. But imagine if it did, when the wood itself is so fragrant, what would be the fragrance of a sandalwood flower? That's like the difference between formless God and the personal form of God. Sugar cane is so sweet. What if it had fruit? Which it doesn't, unfortunately. The whole world is crazy for sugar. Can you imagine if that sugar cane plant had fruit? How sweet would that fruit be? So that's like the difference between formless God and the personal form of God. Now you might be thinking that, okay, this all makes logical sense. However, if you can give me an example, a real example from our history, then I can really accept what you're saying. What kind of example? The best example would be someone who has already experienced the bliss of formless God, and then also gets to experience the bliss of the personal form of God and can report back to us and tell us what's the difference between the two. It's fine if one is saying, oh, I've attained formless God. What about someone who's experienced both? There are many examples, in fact, from our history, and I'll start sharing those with you from the next speech. Boliye Vrindavan Bihari Lal Ki Jai.